Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. All right, quick. What is Jay Powell thinking? Yes, we have come to a Fed meeting week again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today. This one's the 24th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The Fed meeting of which we speak is, of course, the Federal Open Market Committee, the group within the central bank that sets interest rates. Tomorrow and Wednesday are blocked off on the calendars of Jay Powell and the gang as they discuss the price of money in this economy. It is something of a central bankapalooza this week, actually. The European Central Bank meets, and the Bank of Japan, and the central banks in Chile and Indonesia and a couple of other countries. It is just a quirk of the calendar, to be clear, but there are some busy days coming up in the machinery of the global macro economy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
Central banks in more than 20 countries are meeting this week, but some of them will, of course, be watched more closely than others. The Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank.
Japan's an important one, too, as well, because it's one of the largest economies.
Aditi Sahasrabude is an associate professor of political science at Brown University. Japan has been holding off on raising rates and is expected to do the same this week. The Fed is up first, then the European Central Bank, which does make its decisions independently, but
they certainly will probably be paying a lot more attention to what's happening this side of the Atlantic than the other way around.
Also watching the Fed are central banks in developing countries heavily reliant on the dollar. Matthias Matthes is an associate professor at Johns Hopkins.
So some of the central banks of emerging markets often also have to worry more about financial stability, meaning if the Federal Reserve continues to raise rates, that's a worry for them.
Because if rates go up here, global investors may move their money to the U.S. instead of smaller countries that rely on foreign investment.
So that probably increases the pressure on them to raise rates as well, so that they can keep broadly their investments at home equally attractive to the United States.
But the rate decisions this week may not be the most important takeaways. Eileen Grable is a professor at the University of Denver's Joseph Corbell School of International Studies.
What central bank watchers will really be looking at is what kinds of hints do they get out of the communications that come from Fed Governor Powell, the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, as to what they're likely to do in the fall.
Because those hints will shape what the rest of the global economy decides to do. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today to start the week, kind of a busy week, actually, for equities types. The Fed, of course, earnings from some big tech companies as well. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, picking up where Kimberly left off, that is to say central banks and what they're thinking. The Fed, as I said, starts yet another two-day meeting tomorrow. Skip, pause, or another hike, your guess is as good as mine. We will, of course, cover Chair Powell's press conference on Wednesday, but I want to give you a little preview of something he is almost certainly going to say.
Monetary policy affects economic activity with long and variable legs.
He has been saying that, Jay Powell has, a lot.
Long and variable legs.
And not just him either.
Monetary policy works with long and variable lags.
The famous long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags.
Crazy, right? That was Philip Jefferson and Christopher Waller there on the Fed's Board of Governors in Washington. Also Mary Daly from the San Francisco Fed and Raphael Bostic from Atlanta. You get my point, I assume. So just like the Fed takes 2 days to have a meeting, we are going to take the next 2 days to explain where that phrase came from and how it influences monetary policy. Today, long and variable lag, the origin story.
My name is Peter Ireland, and I'm a professor of economics at Boston College.
My name is Vasco Carvalho. I'm a professor of macroeconomics at the University of Cambridge.
My name is Jennifer Burns. I'm an associate professor of history at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Okay, those are our experts. Now, the name you really need to know.
Milton Friedman.
Generally, the term is associated with Milton Friedman.
The long and variable lag is one of these nostrums that's passed into conventional wisdom, but was not conventional wisdom when Friedman started talking about it.
Jennifer Burns has, as it happens, just written a biography of Milton Friedman,
which will come out in November, but is available now for pre-order.
I promised her we'd get the plug in. I hope that's all right. Anyway, Milton Friedman, iconic conservative economist at the University of Chicago, eventually a Nobel Prize winner, first started talking about the long and variable lags of monetary policy in the late 1950s.
What Milton Friedman is meaning with this long and variable lags is that the effects of central bankers on manipulating the interest rate that we all pay take a rather long time to have their full effects seen in the economy.
We've talked about this a lot. Interest rates influence the businesses and the decisions they make and the decisions consumers make and ultimately thus inflation, but it can take a while.
It depends on each episode, and sometimes monetary policy acts decisively and it takes much longer than that. Sometimes it takes less time.
There's a way in which we can miss how revolutionary a lot of what he said was because it's just been incorporated into like, well, this is stuff that everybody knows.
To understand how revolutionary it was when Friedman said it, it's probably helpful to think about what was going on at the time.
The early 1960s mood is extremely confident, right? We're going to put a man on the moon.
I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities.
We know how to get unemployment lower.
We must show the world what a free economy can do.
And if things start to go wrong, we know how to correct. We can fine-tune.
Fine-tuning was kind of a thing during President Kennedy's administration.
The idea was that economists, particularly those advising the president, were fine-tuning the direction of the economy.
In other words, making small adjustments to get a precise outcome, a little bit, if you will, like a photographer, adjusting focus.
If things were slowing down, let's do a quick acting tax cut to speed them up. If things are going too fast, maybe we need to get interest rates up quickly. And we can predict with reasonable accuracy what impact our actions will have.
So that's the era during which Milton Friedman begins raising doubts about how much central bankers or the president can actually control the economy, given the long and variable lags between interest rate changes and the economic response. And the thing about Friedman is that he kind of liked to be a provocateur.
But what was also distinctive about that is he had this enormous bedrock of empirical research that he had spent years and years laboring on. So there was something very solid behind all those provocations.
Friedman became an economist at a time when economics was getting a lot more quantitative and mathematical. He studied that data, but he studied history, too.
Friedman was never believed in fine-tuning. He said, we don't know enough. It's too complicated. If we try to fine-tune, we could end up creating very large and unexpected problems.
There is a danger in taking the equations or the models too literally.
Long and variable lag. At a big picture, is really thought about as an argument for not tinkering too much with the economy.
Our understanding of the economy has obviously changed a lot since Milton Friedman's day. But that phrase, as you heard at the top of this piece, long and variable lag, it still affects how that economy gets managed today. And we will cover that in part two tomorrow. UPS and the Teamsters are getting down to it as a July 31st strike deadline looms. Negotiations broke down earlier this month, but both sides are scheduled to head back to the negotiating table tomorrow. The more than 300,000 Teamsters who work for UPS are looking for higher wages and better working conditions. They have been practicing pickets and rallies. And if they do wind up walking out next week, it'll be the first time in more than 25 years that that has happened. And even a casual look at things over that quarter century will tell you that the delivery business has grown a whole bunch in that time and is becoming a much bigger and more important slice of this economy for both consumers and retailers. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
Latasha Merritt runs Sweet Girl Desserts. She makes and delivers baked goods to customers in and around Newark, New Jersey. On the menu,
banana pudding, rum cake, carrot cake, strawberry cake.
She's keeping an eye on the possible strike at UPS because she gets many of her supplies that way.
Cake supplies, the containers.
Those containers are on her mind because a lot of her customers order individual portions of her cakes, and she gets that packaging via UPS. So if there's a strike,
I don't know how I'm going to be able to get by.
A lot of retailers and manufacturers have pulled the trigger on a plan B, says Karen Donahue of the University of Minnesota.
Increasing their orders right now and having some extra inventory can help them to sort of ride the tide during the time that shipments might be temporarily delayed.
Many have been seeking alternative delivery options, according to Jessica Dankert of the Retail Industry Leaders Association.
A lot of that contingency planning involves expanding that portfolio of carriers, regional and local carriers, parcel carriers that retailers are working with.
Here's the thing, though. UPS workers handle about a quarter of all parcel deliveries across the country, says Greg Zegras, executive vice president at Pitney Bowes.
There is not enough capacity with all of the other providers in the market to pick up the amount of volume that UPS accounts for on a daily basis.
The bottom line for consumers is things are going to cost just a little bit more if the strike happens. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
You know who never goes on strike? David Brancaccio and the hardworking early crew on the Marketplace Morning Report. Every day, like clockwork, all the news you need to get ready for your economic day. Speaking of early, coming up.
Every morning I pop up out of bed before the sun rises.
Up and at 'em. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 183 points today, about a half percent, closed at 35,411. The NASDAQ rose 26 points, about 0.2%, ended things at 14,058. The S&P 500 grew 18 points, 0.4%, finished at 45,054. AMC jumped almost 33% today as the Barbie movie drew in that movie theater chain's biggest crowds in a single weekend since 2019. The toy firm Mattel, maker of the original Barbie, grew 1.8%. I'd have expected more, to be honest. IMAX added 2.9% as Universal's movie Oppenheimer also attracted movie fans. Here's a question for you, though. Is it Barbieheimer or Barbenheimer? Help me. You're listening to Marketplace. Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is a housing tidbit upon which to gnaw for a bit. Existing home sales in this economy were down 23% in the first half of the year from the same period in 2022. That data comes to us courtesy of the National Association of Realtors. And here's the thing about people staying put like that. They don't hire movers or lead paint inspectors or maybe even buy regular paint to touch up a hallway or something. Stephanie Hughes is on the Marketplace desk of businesses adjacent to the stalled housing market for us today.
Ted Jarboe has been moving pianos on the East Coast since the late 70s, though he has never learned to play.
Absolutely not. I don't have any time.
Jarboe's company is based in Central Maryland, and he says the last few years were super busy.
You know, the pandemic caused people to stay at home, do renovation, get rid of pianos, move them out, and that was a big factor.
Others took up the ivories and moved them in. Now, with lockdowns over and fewer people selling their homes, Jarboe says his revenue's down about 15% from last year. Meanwhile, companies that are even more reliant on home sales for income, like mortgage brokers, are really feeling whiplash, says Daniel Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com.
They had scaled up to meet the demand during the frenzy, and now they've had to pull back on staff.
Other businesses are pouring more funds into advertising to try to reach the people who are moving. Timothy Netsley runs a home inspection company in western Montana, which has doubled its marketing budget from last year. He's also started offering new services, like testing for evidence of the drug methamphetamine.
If you smoke it, then the building materials will absorb that and hold on to it, and it will affect the occupants.
Netsley also says it's a good idea for everyone to get their home inspected every year or two, whether they're selling or not, to remind them of what they should be doing.
For example, you're supposed to drain your water heater every year.
But he says nobody really remembers to do that, which means the water heaters last half as long as they might. And Netsley says a track record of maintenance looks good to buyers when people do eventually decide to sell. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Earlier this year, Cambridge, Massachusetts finished up a small guaranteed income pilot program. For a year and a half, ending this past March, 130 low-income single parents got $500 a month to spend on anything, no strings attached. The city has now restarted that program and opened it up to all families with kids that meet the income requirements for a family of three. That's about $62,000 a year. UBI, Universal Basic Income, isn't a new idea. And there is a growing number of cities and counties around the country that are experimenting with pilot programs. Cambridge, though, is the first to expand it to all eligible families, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
To live in one of the most expensive cities in one of the most expensive states in the country, Cara Gauss works two jobs at two different nonprofits, one full-time, one part-time.
When you think of low income, sometimes people think of those who work for minimum wage or those who aren't working at all. Low income in this state could mean that you're still working two jobs and it can be above minimum wage.
As a single mom with two kids, Gauss has only been able to afford to live in Cambridge because she qualified for affordable housing. It was in the lobby of her apartment building in 2021 that she first saw a flyer advertising the city's guaranteed income pilot.
At first glance, I was like, it just felt like it was too good to be true. I was like, no strings attached, just getting it.
But it wasn't too good to be true. She applied and was selected. And she says having an extra $500 a month for a year and a half made a huge difference. She was able to build up her savings, go back to school to finish her bachelor's degree in psychology, and
I also paid off my car. That was the big part.
The idea behind guaranteed income programs is that everyone should have enough to cover at least their basic needs.
Like food and housing and bills.
Tina Alou at the Cambridge Economic Opportunity Committee says after hearing stories from local parents like Cara Gauss about how much the pilot program helped them,
the city and the partners were really committed to being able to expand on it. It was just having the money to be able to do it.
Finding the money for these kinds of programs is almost always an issue. But in this case, Geeta Pradhan at the nonprofit Cambridge Community Foundation says the city had about $88 million in COVID relief funding that it needed to spend.
And we made the case that the population that had actually the highest level of negative impacts from COVID were low-income families.
City officials voted to put $22 million of that funding into expanding the guaranteed income program. Starting this month, all families with kids in the city making less than 250% of the federal poverty line are eligible. For a family of four, that's $75,000. Other cities and counties around the country are also using some of their COVID funding, along with private funding, to experiment with guaranteed income programs.
Literally every week or 2 weeks, we hear about a new pilot.
Sean Klein is associate director of the Stanford Basic Income Lab, which is tracking these programs.
I think right now there's roughly around 60 live pilots, and we've had more than 100 over the past year. So we've really seen kind of a remarkable explosion of interest in this policy idea.
Klein thinks there are a couple of reasons for that.
One is a decades-long kind of creeping economic insecurity, but it was really punctuated, I think, during COVID, which laid bare dramatic inequities.
And COVID relief funding gave cities and counties a lot more money to work with. But once that money's gone, Klein expects many of these guaranteed income programs will end.
Because typically local government doesn't have the revenue base to support it.
In Cambridge, Mayor Sumbul Siddiqui says city officials are already thinking about ways to keep their program going long term.
But I think the only way that programs like this can be sustainable, you know, is through some dedicated funding at the state or federal level.
Which seems unlikely, at least in the immediate future. Nationally, there's still a lot of political opposition to guaranteed income programs. But Siddiqui says she thinks as more places experiment with them and there's more research on the outcomes, that might change.
I think our hope is that Cambridge is helping to pave the path to show how impactful programs like this are.
For Cara Gauz, getting to participate in the pilot program made a big impact. And now that Cambridge has expanded it to all eligible families, she's just started getting those checks again.
For the first round of money, I feel like I focused on becoming more financially stable for myself.
This time around, she says, she wants to start savings accounts for her kids. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
From Massachusetts, we go now to Utah, home of baklava baker Rita Malgati. We've been following Rita and her business, Sheer Ambrosia, since 2020. And it turns out that, historically, summer is kind of a slower time for baklava sales. But she is keeping busy all the same. Here's the update.
I am planning on opening a commercial kitchen in a few months. At the end of 2022... I thought to myself, okay, you know, you've been doing this for a long time now. I've had the business since 2008, and I did venture out into a commercial space from 2013 to 2016. It was a whole different model, and I'm not going to do that again. But my daughter's 19, my son's 23, they're both out of the house now. The only baby I have left in my house is Sheer Ambrosia, and it's time for her to fly the coop too. We found this really cute space in the ballpark area of downtown Salt Lake. It's 600 square feet, so it's a nice, humble spot. And once I take that risk and move into that space, then the opportunities will come. Unfortunately, when I go to networking events and I'm speaking to potential customers, sometimes I feel like I lose credibility when they say, oh, so where's your bakery located? And I say, it's in my home. And they kind of just go, oh, I thought this was a real bakery. So this is going to give me the credibility that I need. I have been saving. I may have to get a loan this time because reach-in double refrigerator was $2,600 the last time. Now it's almost $6,000 for the exact same, so more than double the cost. Every morning I pop up out of bed before the sun rises. I'm running the business, but I'm also trying to help the obstacles of doing a build job. I told my general contractor that it's so important for me to get in there and start working and getting comfortable with all the new equipment way before the holiday season, because it's going to be super busy. I was hoping 1st of August, but I think it might be closer to September.
Rita Magaldi already thinking about the holidays. They are running Sheer Ambrosia in Draper, Utah. This final note on the way out today, in which I confess I've seen neither Barbie nor Oppenheimer yet, but I will. Anyway, their box office prowess you've probably already heard about, right? Here is a real-life thing. Saw this on CNBC. The United States Army, which operates the Trinity site where the first nuclear bomb test happened, holds an open house at that site twice a year. The next one is October the 21st. On the website of the White Sands Missile Test Range, the Army says, and this is a quote, "Due to the release of the movie Oppenheimer, we are expecting a larger-than-normal crowd at the 21 October open house. If you are not one of the first 5,000 visitors, you might not get through the gate." Should you miss this one, by the way? Next open house, April 6th, next year. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. Really, it's more random trivia today, actually, is what it's like. With the letter X in the news, and if you haven't heard or read about it, honestly, you're better off. Anyway, stock ticker symbol X. U.S. Steel, up 2% today, $24.71 a share. I just thought that was cool, that's all. Our daily production team includes Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.